Accession number 19673, Reel 3.
Gordon Graham, Reel 3.
Of course, the best thing for morale in warfare is to be advancing. And by this time, by the time the battalion reached Imphal, the Japanese were in retreat. There was very hard fighting going on around Imphal, but when we next went into action, which was on the road to Tamu, in the Kabul Valley, where we handed over to the 11th East African Division. One of the extraordinary aspects of the Burma War was the variety of races participating. It was like a microcosm of the whole world. There were Chinese, Americans, Indians, British, Japanese, Africans, West Africans, East Africans, and a few Canadians, Dutch, and so on. It was, anyway, we were handing, we took over from an Indian division, 23rd Indian Division, and it should not be forgotten by anyone who wants to get the Burma campaign in proportion that the principal forces on the Allied side were Indians. The Indian army by this time was maybe 50-60% of the total, and they were magnificently trained, and the victory was very largely theirs. The British were minority players in the Burma campaign. In Tamu, before we handed over, we had the extraordinary experience of in one day capturing 28 Japanese, which was not a matter of glory because they were all sick and wounded. We picked them up. They'd been left behind in the course of the retreat. And this gave me, at least, an entirely new slant on the Japanese. A lot of them were just young and frightened, and they were, suddenly they became objects of pity when you saw them in that condition. I'm not sure anyone else felt, many others felt that way, although there was one incident when one of the jocks was cuffing a Japanese prisoner about, and a medical officer said, "Stop that, we've got to live with these people after the war." And so there were interludes of, there was at least one interlude of humanity, but mostly it was just hatred and mutual destruction. And at least you had clarity of mind. Nobody had any doubts. The Japanese had a terrible reputation for cruelty to prisoners, and this sharpened the hatred and the determination of those who were fighting against them. It became counterproductive. And the Japanese, in the ensuing campaign, with the advance into Burma in the winter of early months of 1945, the Japanese were really ruthlessly exterminated by thousands and tens of thousands. Nobody gave it a second thought. They were just glad to be winning, and in the case of the British troops, and I dare say all the others too, just looking forward to getting it over with and getting home. There was nothing pleasant about it. And yet there was this thrill, that sense of reality that here you are facing death under conditions of extreme risk, and it was not all a negative experience. I guess each person who's engaged in the sharp end of warfare is brought to confront himself, either subconsciously or consciously. You get almost into touch with a sense of reality which can be gained in no other way. One's senses become sharpened, and even if there's nothing pleasant or constructive about it, it still is a trial of the human spirit, which has got a positive outcome for those who are ready to acknowledge it.
Why was that soldier knocking the prisoner about?
Just because he hated the bastard. The prisoner was only standing there.
Was he wounded?
Well, he was standing. He was just being interrogated. But of course, the instinct was to, I'm sorry to say, some of the troops shot the Japanese who were lying there sick on the ground, just until I stopped them. And there was no chivalry involved in this war.
What were they sick from?
Oh, mainly malaria and malnutrition, I would say. Mm-hmm. Malnutrition particularly, because their supply lines had broken down and they were starving. Then we advanced into the plains of Burma, and I suppose the high point of that sector of the campaign was the crossing of the Irrawaddy, which had to be crossed under fire from the Japanese. It's a mile wide, and I led the place where our division crossed. I led the patrol across the river a few nights before the D-Day and spotted where we could land, or where I thought we could land. And meantime, they did manage to get some. I mentioned earlier the shortage of landing craft. They did manage to get some, but they leaked. So that it was quite hazardous crossing the river, even without the Japanese opposition. And they did open up when we were on the water, and there were many, many casualties. But we managed to secure a bridgehead through which the rest of the division followed. And then this was about 40 miles west of Mandalay, and so there was the advance. Once we were on the south side of the River Irrawaddy, the advance to Mandalay. But although the Japanese by this time were outnumbered and in retreat, they remained determined fighters, even in situations where they were obviously outnumbered. They did run now and then, but they would also stand and fight it out. And it was no joyride, even when you were advancing. In fact, slightly more difficult. If one had to choose between attacking the Japanese or being attacked by them, one would certainly want to be attacked by them, because they were much easier to kill that way. When they were in defense, they're hard to find in the first place, and then they would fight to the end. And then the the advance continued south. By this time, the decisive battle had been fought at Mike Tila by the 17th Indian Division, which had done a right hook, and the Japanese were in full retreat. And our division was withdrawn once again to prepare for combined operations, because the next step after the reconquest of Burma would be the invasion of Malaya. And this was all planned. And then the atom bomb was dropped. And so the landing took place, not by our division, but by another division, but of course there was no opposition. They landed at Port Swettenham, north of Singapore.
How do you feel now about having taken part in the Second World War with the Camerons?
I don't regret any part of it. It was not only unpleasant, but it was such a negative and wasteful way to spend, well, 6 years of my life. I was in the army. I wasn't demobilized until June 1946. But when one considers one's experiences against the background of the history of these times, I felt, and my age and the age of all my contemporaries, I felt that was the right place to be. I said to myself at the age of 19, it's going to be a war, the place to be is in the infantry at the front. That's what wars are about. And that may have been a innocent, misguided attitude, but looking back on it, I think I was right. There's a sense of satisfaction in having been at the sharp end. There's also a curious sense of conscience about having survived. You feel very bad about those who, your contemporaries, who did not survive. Why were they killed and why was I not? These are questions which lead one into all kinds of philosophical and quasi-spiritual reflections, which I think become an asset in one's subsequent life when one is no longer dedicated to the act of destruction.
And you weren't wounded or you didn't fall sick?
No, I was not wounded. My batman was wounded twice next to me each time. I had a bout of malaria. But of course, we all took pills, so it was swiftly eradicated. So throughout the war, I remained in surprisingly good health. I also won a couple of medals, which took me by surprise rather pleasantly.
You got two MCs?
Yes. One was at Kohima, the other was at the Irrawaddy. And to this day, I don't know exactly what they were for, because I never read the citations. But obviously I was being quite useful.
Now, I think you also had some experience of post-war South Asia.
Yes, yes. After the war was over, I remained in the army, but I got a staff job in Delhi on the staff of General Auchinleck, public relations, which meant writing press releases about General Auchinleck, and a certain amount of censorship was still going on. And I was fortunate there to serve under a very fine newspaper man called Desmond Young. He wrote the book on Rommel, if you remember. He'd been a prisoner in Italy and escaped into Switzerland, and he was in charge of public relations in Delhi by the time I got there. And he was very kind to me, and I formed the intention to become a newspaper correspondent after I was demobilized. And then I suffered a personal tragedy. I mentioned I married in Bombay. My wife died in childbirth in Bombay in February 1946, when my older daughter was born. So I flew home with this infant by flying boat and handed her over to my mother. And I was still in the army, so I was posted to the India office, and still in public relations, but contributed to the organization of the celebrations, particularly of the Indian Army after the war.
Celebrations where?
The big one was in Bush House at the foot of Kingsway. There was an exhibition of the exploits of the Indian Army, where I was instrumental in bringing Mountbatten, Auchinleck and Slim together, which was more of an achievement than I knew, because they didn't normally talk very much to each other. But they were united by the glorifying the, celebrating the achievements of the Indian Army, which they'd all served. Auchinleck and Slim were professional soldiers whose hearts were in the Indian Army, and of course Mountbatten had been there. Commander. So that by the time I was demobilized, I was an acting lieutenant colonel at the age of 25, which is a heady experience to have, but didn't mean anything when you returned to civilian life. You were all of the glamour and privileges of the military life were gone. And like thousands of others, I had either to return to what I'd been doing or decide in some new directions. And as I mentioned earlier, I'd formed a considerable affection for India and the Indians. So when I was offered a job in India, I turned right round and went back there. Still in 1946. You should understand that after the experiences in the forces, away from the civil life of the UK, the UK after the war looked depressing and drab and the joy of the end of the war, which was overwhelming, could not really hide the privations which they had suffered and which were still going on. There was a wartime economy for 2 or even 3 years after World War II, which all seemed so pointless by this time. So I suppose I was one of quite a few who didn't feel at home in my own country and was glad to go back to India, where, of course, I'd had this wartime romance and where I suppose I was feeling, to some extent, a nostalgia for the country, where I then spent the next 10 years of my life.
Doing what?
Well, my ambition was to be a newspaper correspondent, and I did become one. I became a freelance. I had a job until 1949 working for a publisher's agent that got me sort of into the book business. He was also an agent for various other commodities, but books were the big business. And I started writing on the side, and by 1949, I felt able to leave the job and set up on my own. And I ran really an agency for imported books on behalf of the American publishers, McGraw-Hill. Principally, I was writing for their journals. I was also the correspondent of the Christian Science Monitor. And I traveled all over India and indeed Southeast Asia, writing stories and selling books to the universities. They were mainly textbooks. And that occupied me until the mid-1950s. And when my wife and I had remarried in the meantime, we were driving back to India from the UK when I got a telegram. I was in Athens in Greece, got a telegram offering me a job in New York, which I thought about and then finally accepted.
So you were in India for about 10 years from the late 40s to the mid-50s?
That's right, yes.
What did you feel about the direction India was taking at that time?
Oh, I was thrilled. 1947 was, I thought, a great event in the history of human relations. It was a statesmanlike thing for the government, the Labour government, as it was, to do, to finally to relinquish power in India. It was badly handled by Mountbatten, who was in a hurry to get it over with and more or less forced the division of India onto the Indians as the price of independence, which they accepted unwillingly. But the price in human slaughter was much greater than anyone could have foreseen. Millions of Hindus and Muslims slaughtered each other in 1947. But the outcome, nevertheless, was the beginning of a period of great progress and liberation and the forming of a nation. You could see it. I knew most of our friends were Indians, and I wrote a lot about India. I have a scrapbook here I can show you during these years. And it was a time of great hope. So I enjoyed it very much.
And whereabouts in India were you mostly based?
In Bombay.
Had you seen you didn't see anything of the partition violence?
Not in North India, no. I was in Bombay, where the violence was quite minor. But I was in India when it happened. It was August 1947.
What did you see in Bombay at that time?
Oh, riots, you know. The usual Hindu-Muslim riots, which I did. I went to cover riots occasionally. And actually, they're more frightening than being at war. There's a sense of mindless, impersonal, mass violence about a riot, which is worse than a nicely organized battle where you've got soldiers on each side. And of course, the police would fire into the crowds and innocent people would be killed. I found that quite frightening.
Were your friends mostly Hindus or Muslims?
Hindus, Muslims, Anglo-Indians, Parsis, Goanese. Bombay is a cosmopolitan city. It looks both east and west. It was the entrepot from the Western civilization going back to the time of the Greeks. And you therefore could have a very variegated society, all different groups and strata. Provided one was ready to move among these strata, it was a very stimulating place to be. But I must say that there was quite a lot of exclusive behavior, particularly on the part of the British. Not the, by this time, the civil servants and the army and the police had gone, but the commercial British returned. And they still maintained their own society with their own clubs, even managing to maintain clubs into which Indians were not admitted, and I couldn't stand that. So I didn't know very many British in Bombay.
What was the attitude of Parsis in the area to...
Very pro-British. Yes, the Parsis felt themselves to be orphaned by the independence of India because they were highly westernized and by and large had not, in this century, intermarried very much. So they were desolate, as indeed were the Anglo-Indians, and many of whom emigrated.
Did you go to Pakistan as well?
Oh, yes, yes. I went a lot to Pakistan. I covered the principal universities throughout the subcontinent.
What did you feel about what was happening there in comparison?
One felt, I personally was antagonistic to the idea of a nation which was religiously based. I never regarded India as a Hindu country, although the majority of the population were Hindus, but as a collection of loosely knit ethnic groups. Whereas in Pakistan, there was this sense of Muslim certitude that they were the people with the most worthwhile and serious beliefs, and I found this a little off-putting. On the other hand, I had just as many friends in Pakistan individually as I did in India. Many of them were booksellers, librarians, professors. By this time I was moving through the universities, introducing American textbooks in the universities.
Did you have any reservations about the course India was taking in those years?
Yes. The idealism of the Congress Party, which was instrumental in winning India's independence, rapidly deteriorated into factionalism and a fair amount of corruption. And one could see that. On the other hand, the top leadership, as long as Nehru was there, and of course Gandhi, until he was assassinated in 1949, did